This is the Toronto Today podcast. I'm your host, Greg Brady.
640 Toronto presents Think Tank, the breaking stories you care about, facts and opinions that get you through the day. Now, let's meet the guests.
Let's do it. Beautiful sunny morning in downtown Toronto. Welcome to Toronto Today. Thanks so much for listening. And we're going to talk about some fixes for Toronto. Why can't we have nice things? Well, you got to spend $26 million to get them, apparently. We've got Anne-Marie Akins, Media and Crisis Communications Advisor. I don't know how much spare change you have, Anne-Marie, but it all would count for something over the next decade in Toronto, allegedly.
Yeah, not much, so.
Mark Saunders, former chief of police and a Toronto mayoral candidate last year. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Greg.
And we've got Brad Bradford, Toronto City Councilor for Beaches East York in studio. So let's start here on this report, Brad. I'm going to start with you, cut to Anne-Marie, and then I'm really eager to get Mark's perspective. And by the way, I told you and Mark a year ago at this time, admire you for putting your names forward, admire you for running. Being mayor of Toronto is not going to be a very fun job the next 3 years. And when I see numbers like this, no matter who won, Brad, $26 billion over 10 years, does that number look real to you as a city councilor?
It's pretty eye-popping and it's pretty sobering when you see it there on the screen. I would suggest Toronto, our size and our scale is unique, but the idea of the problem, aging infrastructure that was built in the 50s and the 60s that needs to be updated and replaced, that is a challenge that's facing municipalities across the country. And the fact is, no municipality can solve this on the property tax base. Obviously, Mayor Chow was quick to institute a record-breaking property taxes hike, but that's not going to close a $26 billion capital gap. And I think it behooves everybody in elected office to really, you know, focus on figuring out how we can get better value for money. We routinely pay 2 to 3 times on our procurement. We go out to market, and because of all the onerous restrictions of working with the City of Toronto, we make it very difficult to bid on our projects. We'll often get only 2 bids on a project. And you look at municipalities outside of the city, and they have a much more competitive bidding process. It's no secret that we are the only closed shop, meaning we don't have open bids from different unions across the province. We just have 2 here in the City of Toronto. And the Cardis Foundation estimated that that costs us $300 million in additional costs annually. So there are things that we can do to get better value for money. And this has to be the focus of this administration. And in the first 10, 11 months on the job, I am not seeing that. I am seeing an indication to always go and raise taxes in a bunch of different ways, but zero effort made to find savings and to get better value money for taxpayers.
Mark, I'll ask you to react to the number, but also to some of what Brad said. You had different campaigns, different views on how you'd both run the city, but I think there's some sense of alignment in that we won't be able to tax our citizens to pay for infrastructure. They won't stay. They can't afford it. It's already expensive enough to live in Toronto. How do you view a number like this?
Well, Greg, you know, whenever you hear the dialogue of maintaining status quo, which is what they're saying, that is the first indicator that the low energy bureaucrats are hard at work. So Frank's in the office. Someone told him to put 2.6 in a box, and at the bottom of the Excel, you'll see $26 billion. Listen, 10 years from now is not going to be like today. Let's face it. And even right now, status quo for me, I don't like driving on Yonge Street. It's like riding the Mind Buster at Wonderland. They have to prioritize better. It has always been a spending issue with this government, Greg. And when I ran, I was very clear on that. Prioritize. I will tell you, though, the TTC, especially the subway system, that needs to be fixed. And I knew that a long time ago. And we can't have it this Monday to Friday subway system. If you live in the city, you still use it on the weekends. And everywhere, there's somewhere new that's shut down. And that is because it is collapsing. So prioritize, open the books, let the taxpayers know. And by the way, we don't need as many buildings because half the staff is working from home. So there is a good thing that you can take off and figure out how to reprioritize that money.
By the way, your back and neck's in better shape than mine if you're still riding the Mind Buster. I had to retire from the Mind Buster a few years ago. So you're doing the right things at the gym, Mark, if you can handle it. I had to quit it. I need more stability, a little bit more of a shock absorber. Anne-Marie, this is such an important issue. You know, infrastructure is such a vital investment in today and the future. If you can't provide the basics for people, again, they'll look at that city and say, A, I don't want to come back and visit here, and B, I sure wouldn't want to live here 365 days of the year, and that will haunt us for generations if we start to lose families.
Yeah, you know, I'm sitting here where I live, you know, close to the waterfront. But I can see a bridge stuck up in the air. It's an old, old bridge that clearly somebody at some point in time decided we're not going to invest any more in the repair and upkeep of this bridge. We'll just replace it someday. And I think that part has to change in mindsets, that nobody thinks the big expensive repair and maintenance jobs of our infrastructure. This is critical infrastructure that helps us get around, helps us function in our homes, helps us be safe on our streets. Nobody thinks that's sexy. There's no ribbon cuttings. There's no like grand events to say, we're shutting down this highway for the next 3 days to fix it, because we have to maintain it for you. Nobody's doing that. And I think we have to. We have to look at the repairs and maintenance just as important as we do the big, shiny, let's build something new. They are maintenance. Think about it, that these are our homes. And we're not going to say, well, I'm not going to repair this sink because I'll just buy a new one. No, we consistently have to invest in any of the big infrastructure we have, and I think make it more important. And our politicians, I think, have to own it.
And Brad, I often hear it brought up that, well, it's the little things, but the little things are what you remember sometimes. Your hockey team comes into a community hockey rink and there's a drip coming from the ceiling, or like the old story, you go into a bathroom in Toronto, in a Toronto park, and the taps don't work, or the toilet's plugged up, or whatever it is. And those are the things that resonate with people. Like, it sounds simple. It sounds like first world problems, but we live in a first world country and we can't have these problems.
Well, and these are reasonable expectations for taxpayers, yes, to, you know, when you hit the showers Friday night after the hockey game, that the showers actually work. And, you know, how many times have folks found themselves in a scenario where that's not the case? I mean, Anne-Marie makes a good point. She references that bridge that looks like it had a bad run-in with Viagra. It's stuck up there. And, you know, it's emblematic of the fact that these projects get delayed because we do not have you know, the staff and the leadership focused on driving these things forward. Spend rates, which means the dollars going out the door, have been abysmal. And what that translates, so everybody understands, what that translates into is capital projects get deferred, they get delayed from year to year. I saw a spreadsheet just last week with all the different parks projects that are being delayed in my community. And you know what that means? It means that they're $1 million more next year, or $2.5 million the year after. Every time you push these things forward, as consumers see every day, costs are escalating, labor costs are going up, construction materials. So when you don't get it done today, when you push it into the future, that cost is escalating as well. And so we're blowing budgets just by not getting the work done. We overpay, we pay a premium when we're having bids that are coming in that are not competitive. And all of this translates into that, you know, $26 billion capital budget that we're all going to be paying for in the years to come.
And Mark, this is very difficult when people say, I agree with Mayor Chow. She says, we got to fix the stuff we have before we have nice new stuff. But some of that nice new stuff she references, the city seems really committed to pay for. They put into festivals and whatnot. Pride, and it's not the only festival, will cost the city $6 million this year. I'm not saying the city should spend nothing, but $6 million's a lot. Climate is something you're going to have a really tough time convincing people the planet's on fire, and it's the most urgent cause imaginable when people have to move because they can't afford to live here. So there's a ton of issues that are right in front of our face that the city seems fine spending money on, but then hitting the taxpayer with the infrastructure bills.
Exactly. And again, listen, business processes change. Digital technology has huge impact on how we can have cost savings. And we don't need everything we have right now. It's 2024, and we won't need everything we have now in 10 years from now. So where is the strategic thinking in all of this decision making? And I know a couple of months ago, $10 million was put into a beautiful park downtown. You know what? The people in the suburbs don't need that park. Is that park necessary? Is it a priority to have right now? This is post-pandemic. Small businesses are dying. We need to drive our economy. A whole list of things that need to be done. But you know what? The moment we say status quo, it starts off as an absolute failure, nothing short.
I'm sure, Anne-Marie, too, I'll wrap on this. You probably read that article, and it's thought of when we think about the World Cup It is. That's its own entity itself right there. And I understand the concept of it. I understand you got to pay to play. You're promoting your city to the world. But just thinking about that ballooning cost is aggravating when you read about the basics that we're not providing the people that pay the taxes right now.
Well, it is. And it's losing some support from people. But I still think, you know, I live in a neighborhood that was built because of the Pan Am game.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be here. You know, it does get, speaking of infrastructure, it often gets governments motivated to maintain and build infrastructure that we really need. So these games do help cities in that way. And that's setting aside what happens during the games, which I think a lot of people do here in Canada don't appreciate just how big soccer or football, as most Europeans call it, how big it actually is and what it will do for the city.
The federal government yesterday approving British Columbia's request to walk back a policy of decriminalizing illicit drugs. Again, I know this was something that was a big priority of both Mark and Brad during the mayoral campaign last year. First, I want you to hear from the Conservative Party leader of Canada, Pierre Poilievre, about the reaction yesterday to this decision from the federal government.
The City of Toronto submitted a 153-page application, and I quote, seeking an exemption under Section 56.1 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act that would decriminalize personal possession of illicit substances within Toronto's boundaries. The Prime Minister's government has been working secretly with Toronto on that plan ever since. Will he, yes or no, rule out decriminalization in Canada's biggest city?
Here.
Mr. Speaker, we will continue to be there with a thoughtful, compassionate-based public health approach on the toxic drug supply, and that means working with jurisdictions. When Vancouver asked us for an exemption, we said no. We would only work with the province, and that's what we did to work with BC. The same thing when it comes to Ontario or Quebec. We will only work with the provinces.
Okay, Mark, I want to start with you on this. We had National Post writer Adam Zivo on. He thinks this idea of Toronto decriminalizing is now dead. It's not officially dead, but it's as good as dead based on what the federal government did yesterday for British Columbia. I know you were strong last year in saying this would be a disaster, and BC recognized this as well. They had took a three-year project and cut it at 13 months. They didn't want to see what the other 23 months will be like. Do you think this is now dead, or should Torontonians still worry about this?
It better be dead. And you know, newsflash, I'm not a psychic. If you have someone that is addicted on a drug and you give them opportunities and pathways to use more drugs, they will use more drugs. And then when you turn it the other way around and say, well, no, if you criminalize it, people are going to jail because of it, it's a fallacy. The frontline officers are not running out there arresting people because of drug possession. It's usually behavioral. I made an arrest a couple of days ago for the exact same circumstance. Buddy throws a brick through a storefront where there are two elderly people inside, and then he books it. That's when the police arrive, and usually they're under the influence of something. So what makes my blood boil over this is how many people, loved ones, had to die because of this policy that was put in place, how many victims, the neighborhoods degraded, and there was enhanced disorder that happened out west. And that is all because of this, which is not even looked after properly. And they didn't even compare it to Portugal, because Portugal, they made it a health issue, but they put robust treatment therapy and recovery funds in. We still have this hyper-focus on consumption. Consumption does nothing. And when we look at the death rate that increased, and when we look at the toxicology increase, it was all there. And I have a problem understanding when you start talking about it, then you get stigmatized. I do not want people to die. This is about a drug that is high potency. And if we don't do it correct, people are going to die. So we have to stop with the silliness and stop pointing fingers and actually get the funds in the right places to help save lives.
Anne-Marie just got a text listening to us. Any politician who rode the TTC for 2 hours straight would not support decriminalizing drugs. And I think that's landing where people are. Do you think Toronto learns from BC's failure here and they don't pursue this any further?
I think what people don't realize is decriminalizing drugs isn't going to change what's happening on the TTC or anywhere. That the increasing toxic drug supply that has really permeated the street drugs over the last 5 years and is continuing to worsen, that's what's making people die. That's what making people increasingly addicted and dying on the streets. They don't die in supervised consumption sites. Supervised consumption sites save their lives, so they don't die. And then many of them do get into treatment because they're eased into services like supervised consumption sites. But I think what people don't realize is that the decriminalization argument, I think, is a red herring. It's really about, because as Mark said, they aren't police aren't going out there and arresting people because they see you doing drugs. They arrest you for your criminal, you know, other kind of behaviors that you elicit and, you know, cause problems and people complain or whatever. People are not going on to the TTC, like the police, to arrest people for doing drugs. They just aren't.
Brad,
so what's that going to change when you decriminalize it?
Yeah. Brad, I think we've laid this out. You're not going to see arrests and trials and jail time for people possessing hard drugs. But the concept is, what happens from that point on? You've been well documented. You've got two young kids and you don't want right now, hopefully that'll change, to take them on public transit, on a streetcar or on the subway right now. What do you think of this?
Well, you know, and the person texting in is bang on. Like, you can't take the 505 Dundas streetcar without seeing an open-air drug deal. I mean, it's rolling through a number of safe consumption sites, which have been disproportionately concentrated in that area. And you walk around downtown Young Dundas Square, Sankofa Square, at any given time, and you see what it looks like. And I think Mark's right. Like, governments have really abandoned the issue. They leaned into the decriminalization. This was a failed experiment in British Columbia. They didn't put any of the supports in place, anything in place to break the cycle of addiction. We've actually just liberalized it and made it easier for people to pursue. And that's clearly the wrong direction. And pardon the pun, but I think there's an opportunity for sober second thought here and for cities and municipalities across the country to recognize the NDP government in British Columbia has walked this back. They recognize it failed. It did not work. The federal conservatives are saying the same thing, and the liberals are on the same page as well. So when it comes to Toronto, you know, I understand that our application has been back at City Hall for the past year, and it will be really interesting to hear from the mayor on this and our chief medical officer of health, because this was being pursued. But it's news to me that it's just sitting on a desk at City Hall. And I think, you know, frankly, the mayor needs to come out and say that we are not going to be pursuing this because this is not actually going to help that we're concerned about.
How would you evaluate where 25 council members are on this when people say, hey, I hear Toronto wants this? You're like, well, I'm Toronto and I'm a councillor and I don't, clearly.
Well, look, you talk to Torontonians, and we all ought to be taking our cues from Torontonians. And while there are folks that will lean in hard to the idea of decriminalization, I think they only talk about half of the discussion. And again, Anne-Marie and Mark were right, you know, that the interactions with police are largely behaviorally related. It's not about consuming, lighting up a crack pipe. It's about the behavior that follows. And so, counselors see that. We hear that. I certainly do. And again, the ideology or the position typically associated with the left that this is going to be a panacea to end drug consumption and help people who are struggling with a health issue, which is addiction. We have to look at the facts and we have to recognize what's not working. And I don't think it would be helpful here in Toronto.
Mark, what would?
Hey, Greg.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask if you'd give me your audience for 10 minutes, and I can give my platform on transit safety and not to deal with normalizing disorder.
Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
No, I'm not going to take 10 minutes of your time. Okay.
Well, I was going to dare you to try and run us right through the 8 o'clock news. I get in trouble for that. But let me ask, what do you think this does to a frontline police officer? How stressed were they about this? And what are the things they're dealing with right now that, like you said, no one on any side of the political spectrum has a monopoly on caring for people's lives. No one wants to see death. We're all trying to get to the same place, reduce addiction and certainly reduce its influence in public spaces. But what does this do for the frontline officer if we decriminalize this? Think of the work they'd have to do.
Well, first off, you know, law enforcement, they're the nonpartisan folks. They're the ones that are first touch points for 90% of these cases. So that's a failure in itself because there should be other resources doing this, working in conjunction with the law enforcement. Secondly, You decriminalize, then every drug dealer in the GTA is going to come to the best city in the world that has decriminalized all drugs. And then if you want to watch our cities and our neighborhoods turn into a different entity, that's exactly what it will bring. So again, we want to make it a health issue. I think everybody does. Everyone has been impacted by family members, friends, and loved ones with this. It is horrible. We hate seeing people die because of it. And there are ways in which we can do it. But I just do not think that the hyper-focus on consumption and the spending on it and how it deteriorates the neighborhoods and the neighbors that are affected by this are completely ignored by city council. These are things that need to have hard discussions and come up with solutions.
I want to finish on this front and start with Anne-Marie. Canada Post lost $748 million in 2023. I was surprised when I read it was last profitable in 2017. I'm even surprised it was then, because almost everything we do is a digital landscape, especially for residences. So, Anne-Marie, I ask you this. It's a crown corporation. It's taxpayer dollars. I'm not sure anyone would care if mail came to our homes twice a week, three times a week. I don't think people check their mail more than twice or three times a week anymore, unless it comes right through the slot at our front door. What do you think?
Well, if you think about it, 2017 was around the time we started to move into the digital world. And then we got propelled into the digital world when, for all the people that were resistant, you know, and weren't going to get their bill online, they were still wanted to get it by snail mail, you know, all of that business. Then the pandemic happened, and then we were forced to go into the digital world. Our post office workers weren't even working, so we couldn't use it, and we figured out how to survive without getting mail. And now there's no turning back. We get our bills by email. We increasingly have moved onto the digital world. And the other thing that happened is the popularity with people, companies like Amazon, that will deliver whatever you want overnight, sometimes the same day even, where Canada Post had become slower and slower and slower and slower. So I have, because I live in a condo building, a little tiny, tiny little mailbox that if I don't empty of all of the flyers every day, it gets stuffed. So for the occasional thing that does, is real that comes into the mail. So I would be absolutely fine if we reduced it to two times a week, even weekly, frankly. That would, but you would have to deal with all of the flyer companies and all the people that insist on advertising that way.
Literally 20 seconds for each of you. Brad, what about this?
Two observations. My daughter is now pen-pelling with her cousin in Halifax, so that's exciting when those letters hit the mailbox. But I can tell you, as a guy who's knocked a lot of doors, you show up on people's porches, and I see the mail going right into the recycling box below, and sometimes you'll see flyers.
Including
from
your campaign flyers.
Including my campaign flyers, all the literature, and you see it. It's from months of will have passed, and it's still sitting on the porch in a box, so I think 2 days a week would probably serve us all just fine.
Mark Saunders, you seem new school more than old school. Surely mail delivery at the Saunders household could be twice a week, three times a week, and you'd be fine.
With full confession, I'm addicted to Canadian Tire flyers. That's all I need.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, we'll make sure those get sent 7 days a week. We'll even have them drop. We'll drop them off on Sunday. We'll drop seven off on one day. That way you've got one for each day, and you're covered. I got to leave it there. Thanks to all three of you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks for listening to the Toronto Today podcast. We drop the highlights of The Daily Show every weekday morning at 11 a.m. Don't forget, you can hear the entire show on the radio, at home, on your smart speaker. Ask Alexa or say, hey, Google, play 640 Toronto or Toronto Today. You can hear us on between 5:30 and 9 weekdays on 640 Toronto. Have a great day.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.